Vine of the soul. No rain last night. My first words to Diane each morning were usually about the rain. What time it had begun, how long it had lasted, how it might affect our dolphin observations that day. The rain had become like a companion to us, whose daily activities were as important as our own. Many days had passed since we'd attended the wake at San Pedro, and almost all of them had brought rain. But today we were thirsty for it. There had been no rain the day before, nor that night. I had missed its presence even in my sleep. My dreams had been dry and strange, like an orchestra with no strings. "The water is going down," Moises told us at breakfast that morning. Already the water level at camp had dropped 2 inches. The fish, he said, would go to the Amazon, and the dolphins would follow. So, crying, "Spines! Branch! Ants!" we threaded our way north through the flooded forest to one of the channels leading to the Amazon, thick, brown, and wide as a sea. We waited, but saw no dolphins there, not even Moises with his Amazon eyes. So Moises directed our canoe through a young, mostly submerged forest of Cecropia, as our cries of ants increased, to a little thatched stilt house by a flooded breadfruit tree laden with green globes the size of grapefruit. A beautiful young woman in a blue dress was swinging her baby on the porch. "Where have all the dolphins gone?" Moises asked her in Quechua. A long conversation ensued, with much waving of arms. Later he told us they had all gone to a lake with no name, an hour from here. We didn't have enough fuel to get there today, but that night we would meet the dolphins another way. We had arranged for Ricardo Pipa, the local shaman, to come to camp. Ricardo, 62, is a thin man with a wide, humble smile, a close-cropped mustache, and a deep cough. Quite soon after we arrived in Peru, Diane and I had met him at a logging camp named Ramirez near the lodge. While Diane played with a captive squirrel monkey, I had talked with him about the dolphin spirits, as Moises translated. Although Ricardo was gracious and Moises worked hard, it was one of the most difficult interviews I'd ever conducted. My hearing is bad to start with, the victim of too many old boat motors on third world rivers, and Moises' voice is so soft I often couldn't tell when his Spanish had ended and his English translation had begun. And on this day, his English was flagging. He mixed up man and woman, he and she, week and month, and he dropped words as casually as one peels a fruit. To clarify, I sometimes asked him to spell a word, making things worse. In Moises' alphabet, which I was only able to decode much later, what is pronounced as A means E, and E means I. In addition, while we were talking, we were under attack from a plague of biting triangular horseflies swarming up from the water beneath the slatted floor on which we sat. As they bit our thighs and buttocks, we slapped at them violently, derailing Ricardo's narrative. Also, both Ricardo and I were afflicted with coughing fits. "Jungle cough, gone in a month," Moises had assured me. Later, when I played back the tape of our interview, Diane and I howled with laughter. Each of my questions in English elicited a series of mumbles in Spanish and Quechua, violent slapping noises, followed by curses in three languages, and periodic coughing duets. But I was able to glean how, 25 years ago, Ricardo had learned the powers of the dolphins. He was already studying to be a shaman at the time, he said, having learned the secrets of many plants. He went fishing one night on the Amazon when he heard a voice calling him from the dark forest. He followed the voice to a tall, pale woman with long blonde hair. Together they walked to the water's edge, where he saw a rock that shone with a light as brilliant as the moon. He picked it up, and as he did, he saw many dolphins jumping in the water. "This light," the woman said, "is my encanto, the power I want to give to you." And then she disappeared. But she came to him in dreams. Together they traveled with the dolphins to the great underwater cities of the Ancant. She taught him the Icaros, the prayers to call the dolphins. For 6 months after that, dolphins would follow him by day in the water and at night in his dreams. The dolphins showed him their powers. "They are the protectors of all the animals in the water," he said. The fishes, the caimans, the stingrays, the boas. The dolphin doesn't like it when people fish too much, Moises interpreted, and then he breaks the nets. Moises here added that he knew this was true, because once an older brother had caught a big fish with a thrown bamboo harpoon. When the fish became tired, a dolphin came and pushed the fish away from his brother's canoe and broke the harpoon in half. And wild pigs, when they cross the river, the dolphin is angry. The dolphin can kill those animals. He is boss for the water, he said. The dolphins also taught Ricardo their medicines, their prayers, and their chants, he explained. It was the dolphins who taught him to speak the Wambisa dialect, he said. They also gave him many Icaros. While he was learning from the dolphins, he was forbidden to hunt land animals. But the dolphins brought him great luck in fishing. Still, he has an Encanto the beautiful woman gave him. Where is it? He doesn't keep it in his house, Moises explained. He keeps it in his mind. Still, many different witch doctors try to steal it from him. Catfishes and caimans, too, try to steal it away. But the dolphins always protect him, and he can call the dolphin spirits whenever he needs them. He calls them in a trance, which he achieves by drinking a powerful potion called ayahuasca, made from two of the most sacred plants in the forest, toei and ayahuasca. I had heard of ayahuasca. In Quechua, it means vine of the soul. Many Amazonian tribes use this powerful hallucinogen to achieve trances in their sacred rituals. The Jivaro of Ecuador call it yage. The Tucano of Brazil call it capi. The great English botanist and explorer Richard Spruce recorded reports of the drug's powerful effects. The sight is disturbed, and visions pass rapidly before the eyes, wherein everything gorgeous and magnificent they have heard of or read of seems combined, he wrote. But, his report continues, soon the scene changes. They see savage beasts preparing to seize them. They can no longer hold themselves up, but fall to the ground. Moises had taken ayahuasca himself thrice, and he did not plan to do so again. In 10 minutes you don't feel your bones in your body, he told us. It comes too much in your head. Bad things, angry things. The visions can be terrifying. In one, Moises had been attacked by vampire bats. Almost everyone who takes the drug vomits copiously, and yet the nausea persists long after the stomach is empty. Some people shriek in uncontrollable fear. Most lose control of the bladder and bowels. But shamans are different, Moises explained. Ricardo, he assured us, is a very strong man, and he uses ayahuasca several times a month. He's learned not to vomit the drug, for if you do, he said, the mother of the vine leaves you and can no longer lead you to the spirits of the underwater world. Before we left Ramirez, Ricardo and I had come to an agreement. The night before we were to leave for Roxanne Kramer's camp on the Arapa River, Ricardo would come to the lodge and perform a ceremony. With the help of the ayahuasca vine, he would ask the dolphin spirits to come to us this very night. The ceremony began at 8:30 in the room next to ours at Paul's camp. Ceremonies are usually conducted at night, Ricardo explained, because he can talk with the spirits more easily when there is less noise. We sat in a circle. I at Ricardo's left, Diane to my left, Moises to her left. A hurricane lamp glowed in the middle of the floor. On an earlier night, for a good luck ceremony to bid Jerry farewell, Ricardo had worn a headdress of blue and gold macaw feathers and an X-shaped halter made of red beans, bamboo seeds, and porcupine quills to attract the spirits. That ceremony was conducted by lamplight, and Ricardo had told us we could speak and even take flash photos. But tonight, Ricardo wore only brown pants and a short-sleeved shirt of white cotton. Once the lamp was snuffed, we should not turn on our flashlights, and we should not speak. The mother of the vine, not Ricardo's finery, would attract the most powerful of spirits, and we should be careful not to disturb them. Ricardo lit his pipe. It was filled not with tobacco, but with a type of incense made from a plant in the same family as myrrh. He blew the honey-sweet smoke over the small aluminum pot of ayahuasca. to put in the Icaro, explained Moises, and then drank 3 deep draughts. He stood up briefly to go outside and spit over the rail. When he returned, he began to shake a bundle of shaka palm leaves to call the spirits. He blew smoke hard and close on the top of my head, where a dolphin would breathe, I thought, and shook the palm over each of us in turn. I was first, and the blessing showered my head with little gnats who had sheltered in the leaves earlier while the bundle had sat on a table. Ricardo snuffed the light, and he began to whistle in the darkness. The tune seemed as innocent as something a schoolboy might whistle on a summer day. The whistling changed to a chant. The words sounded to me exactly like the Onondaga language I'd heard when I was in college, when I would visit the reservation near the university and feed apples to the buffalo. The words I found calming and sweet as incense. Beneath my closed eyelids, I saw caterpillars, then butterflies, then leaves, then birds, a gentle stepladder of becoming. I thought, what a kind and gentle man to shepherd us to the Ankant. Time stopped during the ceremony. The sound of the shaking leaves reminded me of rain. Between the cadence of the leaves and the mesmerizing whistle and chant, I felt myself slipping toward sleep. Sleep, I decided, is a kind of water, and dreaming a kind of river. I scratched my insect bites to stay awake. I felt an unusual peace slip over me. And then, hours or minutes later, we felt a change. The close, hot room suddenly was refreshed. The leaves now sounded like a jar of water being shaken, and I realized that it had in fact begun to rain. A word came into my mind. Mother. The rain came harder and gathered power, and Ricardo began to speak in a different language. I reached out and held Diane's hand. Thunder and lightning concluded the ceremony. We crept out of the room, leaving Ricardo to rest. Moises interpreted for us what had happened. Ricardo had spoken with the Mother of the Vine. He had met with the dolphin spirits, and yes, they were willing to speak with us. "They want to come to you," Moises translated. "The dolphins want to teach you their powers. And when the dolphins teach you that power, the spirit will be with you everywhere, even in the States, all the time." "They want to come to you," he said again, "and they will speak to you in English, in French, in Spanish, and in Quechua. They will speak directly to you. Tonight," he promised, "they will speak to you in your dreams. Tomorrow, Ricardo," he explained the dream, "the dolphins will send dreams for 3 nights. Ricardo will tell what they mean. But if you learn the secrets of the vine, they will speak directly to you in voices you understand." "The dolphin wants to talk with you very long," Moises said. "And if you want to see the dolphin city, the Ankant, he will show you. He will take you there." "But to do so," he said, "we would have to drink the vine." As Moises told us this, at each pause there was thunder or lightning. "The rain is good for concentration," Ricardo had told him. It rained all night. At 6 a.m., when Diane woke me, it was still raining. It seemed auspicious, she said, that the mother would send a woman rain to us 2 women, seeking knowledge about the dolphins. I woke and tried to recall my dream. It seemed disappointing, too simple and vague to be a vision. It was only this. Diane and Moises, Mario and I, took the canoe to Ricardo's house. We had a large egg-shaped object to hand to him. The shape, I now realized, of a beautiful light green egg case of a snail we had found the day before. I handed it to him, and he took it. There were no words in the dream, no other people, no other objects. The meaning of the dream seemed obvious to me. Clearly, I was dreaming of what I hoped to do the following morning. The egg case, with its seeds of new beginnings, was my dream, and I was handing it over to Ricardo. Diane's dream was dramatic, long, vivid, and complex. It involved a handsome suitor, an old man, wedding rings, coffins, and wailing mourners. Obviously, my dream was inferior. I was sullen at breakfast, poorly concealing my jealousy. Ricardo had stayed the night in our camp. and he'd agreed to come with us to Wasey on the way to his house at Esperanza to watch the dolphins with us and to interpret our dreams. Mario tucked the boat into a grassy bank. Moises asked me for my dream first. He discussed it with Ricardo and then replied, "In your dream, you want to see the dolphin spirit, but you will not recognize him. He may be appear as your friend, your husband, or wife. Many things in dreams can be transformed." The canoe in which we traveled in my dream, he explained, was the dolphin's boat, the boat in which he would take us to the Ancant. And the giant egg case? When Ricardo blew on your head, he asked the mother of the vine and the dolphin spirit to give you power. A shell, a gun, a spear, a machete. The thing in the boat is the thing the dolphin wants to give you. When you drink the vine, the dolphin spirit will give you a defense also. When you drink the vine, you'll receive big powers, Ricardo promised through Moises. Jaguars and eagles, big demons and big bats, they will help you and stay behind you always. Now Diane came forward in the canoe to reveal her dream. "I had a handsome young lover, but there was also an old man in love with me," she began, and my heart sank lower. "In her dreams, beautiful Diane has two lovers vying for her. My dreams deliver only the egg case of a snail." "I was not in love with him," Diane continued, "but I chose him over the young lover." With the old man, Diane went to the jewelry store to pick out a wedding ring. The jeweler showed her case after case of big diamonds. The old man, smiling, urged Diane to pick the biggest one, but she said she'd be happy with the smallest. Then Ricardo appeared in the dream, and he handed her another box filled with diamonds. They went into an adjoining room to look at the rings and found the room was full of beds with dead people lying in them. When Diane picked out a ring, it turned into yellow plastic with a gray gorilla on it. How odd! In the dream, Ricardo told her not to worry, that she should wear the plastic ring till the diamond ring was ready. Then Diane and the man walked outside. Beneath the store, they saw people dressed in black wailing. "But it was okay, because we were very happy," Diane said. And then the old man walked into the jungle. Ricardo was pleased with the dream. "The black young man is a gray dolphin," he said, meaning the Tukushi. "The tall white man who give you the ring is the pink dolphin." Both these interpretations surprised us, because in Diane's dream, the young lover had not been black, nor the old man tall. They may well have become so in Moises' interpretation. Ricardo continued, "The ring is the dolphin's powers. The yellow color is good luck. Someday, if you get sick, the gold color will help you. The diamond is your defense. Glass is good luck for you. So is clear water. The rooms the dolphin shows you are his home. The beds are the beds in the hospital." The Ancant has very good hospitals, Moises had stressed to us earlier. "And the wailing mourners?" "This, too, was a good sign," said Ricardo. "These were really dolphins praying and rejoicing at seeing Diane." "Your dream is very good," he said. "All the people you see are dolphins. The dolphins want to give you many things. The dolphins looked last night more for Diane than for Sai." I felt an utter and complete failure. I couldn't follow the dolphins in the water. I couldn't spot them from the treetops. And now they eluded me even in my dreams. I despised myself with a vehemence that took me by surprise. It made me wonder whether the anti-malarial drug I'd been taking for a month and a half was making me crazy. Later, Diane and I would discover that this is in fact a known side effect of the drug. Dear Moises must have seen the disappointment on my face, for he added gently, "Sai, you will have a dream the next time." "For the next two nights," he said, "we should record our dreams, and Ricardo would interpret them for us. We would be traveling to Roxanne Kramer's camp on the Yurapa then, bringing her camp manager the supplies we had promised." When we came back to the Tuwayo, though, the spirits would speak directly to us. For on that night, with Ricardo there to guide us on the journey, Diane and I would take the vine. The journey to Roxanne's camp took 9 hours. Within 50 minutes, we joined the Amazon, or Marañón, the mother river of the Amazon, Moises explained, whose headwaters are born in the cloud forest. From the Amazon, we would take the Rio Ucayali, whose tributaries arise from Machu Picchu, the ancient city in the Andes of the Incas, east via small channels to the Arapa, to the lodge where Roxanne named Dolphin Corners. The Amazon was wavy like the ancient's wine-dark sea, red even though it's technically whitewater here, and can stretch a mile wide. The opposite bank, with its tall stands of canabrava grass studded with dangling tassels like the barbed tips of spears, and in fact, Moises said, this bamboo is used to make spear shafts, seemed far away. But it was not a bank at all, but one of thousands of islands that rise and fall here like waves, as the river, snake-like, eats and digests and finally excretes the land. When I worked here 3 years ago, Moises said, the Yarapa was parallel to the Ucayali. Now they join at an angle. At the mouth of the Yarapa, he told us, there is a sunken village. 3 years ago, he watched the river swallow it. The entire village disappeared in a month. My father said to me, Moises recalled, that water is a natural thing. Man don't stop that thing, just the god. And so it should be, Diane and I nodded in agreement, but this is no longer true. We remembered that one of Vera's chief fears for the dolphins was the hydroelectric projects Brazil envisioned for its river systems. A series of some 80 dams were proposed in the 1980s to harness 5,828 megawatts of the Amazon's yearly energy for southern Brazil. Each dam blocks the routes of the migratory fishes, she pointed out. One small dam, in the state of Pará, caused a 77% extinction of fish species. Only 5 species are left there, and only 2 of those are still abundant. The dolphins, unable to adapt from a diet of over 50 species to only 2, are nearly gone. We soon saw more evidence of man's growing power over the Amazon, a tugboat pushing 2 giant barges loaded with a herd of yellow cat bulldozers, masked like mechanical dragons. Moises said they were headed for the Pastaza River, where American companies were drilling for oil. The Pastaza arises from Ecuador. In the 1930s, Royal Dutch Shell discovered pools of floating oil near the Andes' eastern foothills, and by 1938 the company had blasted a route along the cliffs of the Pastaza Canyon, the first road across the Andes in Ecuador, and the beginning of a 315-mile pipeline that traverses the Andes and oil drills that spread across the forests of Ecuador and into Peru. Most of Ecuador's oil production, some 300,000 barrels a day, comes from the Amazon region, and its waterways suffer. In July 1992, the month after the Earth Summit Conference was celebrated in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, a major oil spill in Ecuador released 27,000 gallons of oil into the Napo River, where Moises had grown up. The effects on the river animals were undocumented. The only instances of accidental dolphin mortality that we're aware of, Vera and her husband Robin had written in their landmark paper, Biology, Status, and Conservation of India, are associated with oil exploration. João Pena had told them that American companies, contracted by the Brazilian government, were exploding large charges of several hundred pounds of dynamite along the length of the main tributaries of the Amazon. The explosions were followed by clouds of fish, turtles, and dolphins. They floated up dead, like ghosts rising from the Ancant. But tourists are seldom aware of these events, and they still flock to the Amazon as a mecca of wildness and wonder. And visitors like ourselves, too, can unwittingly spoil the very wildness they seek. As we approached Roxanne's camp, suddenly it seemed that motorboats filled with blonde gringos were everywhere, zipping along fast enough to overturn a villager's canoe. There are 6 lodges situated along this 5-mile stretch of river, a concentration that has served to increase the population of local people attracted by the wealth tourists sporadically provide. The village of Porto Menguel, located at the center of the string of lodges, has grown from a population of about 150 10 years ago to over 1,000 today. With the increase of population has come an increase in hunting and farming, and the tallest trees along the river are now the weedy cecropias, evidence of secondary growth after older trees have been flooded or cut down. At Dolphin Corners, we were met by Roxanne's camp manager, David Olive. Slender, bespectacled, graying, and obviously weary from his duties, he was nonetheless delighted to have visitors who did not need medical attention. His young wife, a local girl, was away visiting her mother, leaving him in charge of the camp and its human and animal residents. Ramon, a deaf-mute with crippled hands and feet, helped David care for orphaned animals. Wilder helped with boat motors, and Samuel was the camp's chief carpenter. In the camp's round, thatched dining hall lived a young orphan toucanet named Bottomless, and two canary-winged parakeets, also orphans. More birds lived outside, some caged, others loose. Penelope, the guan, stalked about on elegant stork-like legs. She liked to perch on the rails along the walkways, from which height she looked down upon people with an imperial red stare. On a harness hooked to a dog run over the grassy yard, a woolly monkey named Carlotta immediately wrapped me in her four limbs and long prehensile tail. Her body felt feverishly warm. Her normal body temperature, David later told me, is 102 to 103. I loved her embrace, but eventually had to pry her loose. When we returned to the dining hall, out came two adorable baby Wakari monkeys. With naked bright faces, auburn coats, and funny stump tails, they resembled tiny orangutans, although locals, having never seen orangutans, say they resemble sunburned tourists. They are named Amadeus and Ludwig. They touched everything, first with their lips, then their tongues. As the babies hurled themselves around the room, David told us his story. He came from the States to Peru 37 years ago to manage the Holiday Inn in Iquitos. He met Roxanne there in 1980. She walked up to the reception desk with an ocelot in her arms. It was an orphan she'd rescued from a restaurant, where it had been kept chained as a sideshow. I told her she could have it, but it would have to stay in the bathroom, he recalls. The next time they met, the Holiday Inn had folded, and David was working at a lodge called Amazon Village. David had trained in the army as a paramedic, and Roxanne asked him to manage her newly purchased camp and run its free clinic. The pay was bad, the equipment meager, but he took the job. In Korea, we did some nasty things, he said. In Nam, we did some nasty things. Now I want to give something back. The clinic now treats patients from 14 area villages. Last year, he saw 1,260 people for ailments as diverse as diabetes, conjunctivitis, complicated childbirth, broken bones, rashes, malaria, worms, 10 cases of snakebite. Locals can't believe that the treatment is free. What do you charge? They always ask him. Today I'm charging double, he sometimes replies. Give me a big smile. Gratefully, they try to repay him anyway. One child brought him a bandana filled with eggs. His supplies, compared to his patient load, are still deficient. He has no anesthetics whatsoever. His snakebite antivenin expired in July 1995. He was down to 9 bottles of antibiotics, 6 enemas, a single jug of milk of magnesia. He gratefully accepted our supplies, which Diane had procured from a neighbor who works at a hospital. David entertained us with his stories during an enjoyable dinner. He told us about some of the dolphins who frequent the camp. Sadie, who with her baby will approach within 6 feet, Isabel, whom he describes as like my wife, zipping around all over the place, back and forth, back and forth. Marie and Daphne, who look identical, except Daphne has a white scar on her dorsal. Old Fart, the one who spouts the loudest and sounds like Jolly Green Giant after eating all his own beans. He told us again a story we'd already heard, how dolphins had saved Roxanne from a bull shark. He'd heard this story but not witnessed it. And he told us a story Roxanne hadn't told us, how one day a male dolphin had rammed her while she was swimming, knocking her hard with his snout under her left breast. It may have been the breeding season, and he may have mistaken her for another male. Or, I thought, had the dolphin been using his sonar, he would have seen that this was the precise location of her heart. They are very strong animals, David said. We shouldn't underestimate them. Roxanne, David explained, spends most of her time in the States raising funds, which is why we were not able to hook up with her in Peru. Meanwhile, David stays here, preoccupied with day-to-day disasters. An anaconda killed all his chickens. Pit vipers hide in the bamboo. He keeps cutting it down, and Roxanne, who thinks it's beautiful, keeps planting more. His latest difficulty, he said, was a plague of vampire bats in camp. That was why the green mealy parrot in the cage outside is so lonely, he said. Vampire bats killed its companion. This was not in the brochure, I whispered to Diane. At that moment, a cockroach jumped onto my face and then ran down my arm. I flicked it away, directly onto Diane's plate, from whence she flicked it across the room, like some kind of insect badminton. And then a mammal ran over my foot. A rat, David said. I discreetly folded my legs up on the chair, Indian style. One other thing, David said, as we were about to go off to bed. There might be tarantulas. One had dropped onto his chessboard in the middle of a game the other day. Oh, my God, said Diane, the one thing I'm terrified of. I said, there might be, Diane countered. In our room, said Diane. Well, tuck your mosquito nets in tight. We were unmolested by tarantulas that night. Instead, I was visited by other invertebrate interlopers. Chiggers, the legacy of my cuddle with Carlotta, were now crawling beneath my skin. The itching woke me up at 3 that morning. But there was nothing to be done. We went out to look for the dolphins. At a small deep lake ringed by kapok trees and veiled with water lettuce and giant white lily pads, whose yellow stamens were crowded with coppery beetles, we found them. We watched them till sunset. They rose and fell like waves, leaving wakes of quicksilver that lingered on the lake the way dreams linger in the soul in early morning. The lake rang with the weird cries of horned screamers, corpulent black and white birds whose call sounds like a cross between a monkey and a goose, a song alternately gulped and honked and alarmingly loud. By evening, my chigger bites were already infected. Each bite sported a hot red aureole as big as a quarter, with a swollen circle of pus in the middle. It looked as if my entire midriff, from back to front, was covered with nipples. Everyone at camp examined the bites with great interest and offered different cures and prognoses. David said to cover them with sheep dip or nail polish, and they'd be gone in 3 days. Alas, I told him, I left my sheep dip at home. Unfortunately, Diane did not have nail polish. Normally she would have, to touch up her toenails, but she'd left it home. Diane felt DEET would work. Moises said to rub the bites with lemon, and they would be gone in 24 hours. So after a full day of excruciating itching, now was the moment I'd been waiting for. With a plate of cut lemons, a bottle of DEET, and Diane to do the bites on my back, we headed off to the cold, dark shower to do battle with the chiggers. Just at the threshold of the shower, I noticed a 2-foot dark red snake on the raised board walkway. I stepped over it. I hoped Diane, who was behind me, wouldn't notice. Fuck! But she did. Si, there's a goddamn giant fucking snake on the walkway! I was hoping you wouldn't notice, I said. Jesus, it looks poisonous! It's a giant goddamn fucking poisonous snake! It might be poisonous, I conceded, but it's not even in the strike position. Oh, come on, I'm crawling with chiggers here. Just step over it. I can't do my back without you. Diane, however, refused to step over the poisonous snake. Instead, she went to get Moises. The snake must have sensed something was amiss, for it wisely crawled under the walkway and dropped into the water before Moises arrived with his machete, eager to kill it. A snake that color, he said, could only be an aguaje machaca, a venomous water viper. Finally, Diane stepped over the threshold into the bathroom. In the dark shower, with mosquitoes swarming from the drain and the ceiling corners littered with the shed exoskeletons of large spiders, I stood naked and shivering as we dosed my angry skin with insecticide and fruit juice and cold river water. You realize, don't you, I said to Diane, that I have been looking forward to this moment all day. The trip home was exhausting and itchy. We were both nervous about taking ayahuasca. So, it seemed, was everyone else in camp. Steve had gallantly promised to attend the ceremony. I was glad because he knew how to restrain crazy people. I had no idea how Diane or I would react to the drug. I remembered all the stories I'd heard in high school and college about people on acid who jumped out of the windows of tall buildings. Moises would stay with us during the ceremony, too, and also Graciela and Gladys. The women, ever practical, wisely brought an enormous plastic basin into the room and explained this was where we were supposed to throw up or excrete any other material the ayahuasca brought forth from our bodies. We were warned not to leave the room or to expose ourselves to any light, or it could permanently damage our eyes. Nor should we speak. But Ricardo would know if we were in trouble, Moises assured us. If you be scared, if you throw, Ricardo will blow smoke on your head to help, Moises promised. The mother of the vine protect you. She will watch you for 3 days, and then you are free. Then he asked, "You ready?" Ricardo began the ceremony. Blowing incense over the bowl, he handed us the ayahuasca. It was warm and thick as blood, and bitter as bile. We both drank 3 deep draughts. Each swallow brought a shudder as a tidal wave of nausea swept us both. I had planned to wait for its effect, repeating some kind of calming mantra, "Mother of the vine, come to me," or something like that. Instead, my mind chanted desperately, "Don't puke, don't puke, don't puke." Ricardo snuffed the light and began his whistling chant. I held Diane's hand with my left and Steve's with my right, feeling my body swirl with the drug. I waited for the visions to take me. The first vision came quickly. Inside of my closed eyelids, it materialized, a jaguar in the moonlight. I realized this was a powerful omen. The Barasana people of Colombia consider jaguars the intermediaries between earth and sky, life and death, spirit and soul, water and land. And no wonder, this largest American cat is master of the worlds, for it can swim powerfully, climb trees like a leopard, and is active day and night. The Kayapo Gutierrez say the jaguar originally owned fire. Now you see it only reflected in its eyes. In fact, the Kayapos called the first flashlights they ever saw jaguar eyes. Among the Tirios, with whom my friend Mark Plotkin has lived, a shaman may take on the form of a jaguar, in whose form he is capable of unbridled ferocity. The Shipibo say a man who wants to become a powerful shaman will see a vision of a huge jaguar entering his anus and emerging from his mouth. Thereafter, spells cast by the shaman are so strong they cannot be broken. It seemed I watched the jaguar for many minutes. Its silver, devouring eyes stared directly into mine. It didn't move, I didn't move. And although I had seen this look on the faces of tigers and knew what it meant, I was completely unafraid, for I was aware that this was a spirit jaguar. If it chose to devour me, I would submit. Had the jaguar appeared to tell me something? No words came into my head, no message. Its presence was enough. And then its eyes dissolved into my own. I saw my own eyes staring back at me under my eyelids. This eerie vision, after many minutes, dissolved too, as I felt Diane let go my hand. She was going to throw up, something she was desperately hoping not to do. Since vomiting is something not even she can pull off with style, she was intent on bypassing the basin, retching privately, outside over the rail. But when she made her escape out the door, the 2 other women followed to make sure she didn't fall into the water. I tried to get up, but noticed my legs were no longer attached to my body. Over the next 3 hours, my main preoccupation was trying not to throw up. Ricardo must have known this, for at the times the nausea was worse, he blew incense over my head, and the rhythm of the shakapalm quickened. Steve and Diane later told me they felt me shaking with the effort to keep the drug in my body. I wanted the dolphins to come. I wanted to see the unkind. I waited for some message, some vision. Finally, I could stand it no longer. I crawled drunkenly to the door to retch over the rail of the walkway. I didn't feel any better. By now the drug was in my blood, not my stomach. And so what was making me sick was my brain, I reasoned hopefully. Perhaps there would still be more visions. Supported by the contingent of staff who had raced to help me, I returned to the little room. The ceremony went on, and so did the nausea. I began to think that of all the ailments I had suffered, this was the worst. This was worse than the time I got seasick shark-tagging with a biologist. Just as I was turning green from the chop, he decided this was the time to lure the sharks and poured overboard a bucket of fish blood. This was worse than all the diarrhea I'd suffered in 4 trips to India. This was worse than the time I got dengue fever. I'd been with Diane at a Dayak Tiwa in Borneo, drinking rice wine flavored with the corpse of a fetal deer out of a human skull. But at least with dengue, I'd gone unconscious for 3 days and missed the discomfort. Diane had watched over me then, and before I passed out, I gave her instructions that if my body began to stink, she should call my husband and tell him I'd died. Finally, Ricardo stopped chanting, and Moises pronounced it was over. In the morning, Ricardo would interpret our vision and dreams. "How do you feel?" Moises asked us. "Fresh as a daisy," I answered. "Fantastic," chipped Diane. "Did I mention I feel like I'm going to die?" I said to Diane and Steve when everyone else left the room. "Maybe you are," Diane replied. "That would be an improvement," I said, and we three dissolved into a fit of giggles. We felt so miserable, it was funny. Hours later, still floating on great waves of nausea on my bed in our room, I received my final vision. "Diane, do you see anything?" I asked. She had been dreaming sporadically, she said, pleasant images of canoes sliding over taffy-colored water, the dorsal fins of pink dolphins. "Well, you won't believe what just showed up under my mosquito net," I said. "What?" There, hovering above me, as clear as a broadcast of Star Trek, was the perfect replica of the Starship Enterprise.